We are in the midst in this nation of some remarkable circumstances right now. Primarily in this nation, we're at war. And as I was watching the news this week and watching some of the headlines in the local paper and reading on the internet, Thursday's headline in the Spokane paper, starting out, the newspaper said, "Support for the U.S. erodes." And then they showed a chart with all the nations around the world that they could basically find, effectively, that said, you know, we don't think as much of you as we used to. We don't like you the way we used to. Even some of the people we give billions and billions and billions of dollars to seem to have an unfavorable opinion of us. Seems to me something there's not working. Friday, the front page on the paper had an incredibly huge smiley face of Saddam Hussein, who's obviously getting ready to go to work at a department store somewhere because they have to have those pictures as you walk in of all the managerial staff. I've never quite seen him smile so bright. He looked like a kind of a pleasant guy, someone you might want to be on picnic with. Today and this morning on the internet, I see where they've turned in their list of no weapons of mass destruction. The document was 11,807 pages long. Now, if you turned in a paper at school and you didn't have any of the answers to the test, how many pages would that take to put that down? Would it take 11,000 pages to say we have no weapons of mass destruction? So I watch this process. On the one hand, we're at war. On the other hand, life goes on just like absolutely nothing has happened at all, like nothing has changed. Stores are filled with goods, every possible description. The dock strike is over. At least what I can tell, they've cleared much of the backlog and shipped it on out to the stores. Everywhere I go, there's sales and opportunities to buy and purchase. If you have a little bit of money in your pocket, there's some place you can surely put it right away. Milk is $2 a gallon at the gas stations. If you pick it up when you fill up your gas at the car and the gas. Top sirloin steak, $1.88 a pound at Tidyman's. I think that's probably cheaper than when I was a boy. Macaroni and cheese are 4 for $1 at Albertsons. So if you need to eat for a quarter, go to Albertsons till Tuesday and you can buy, feed 4 people for a buck. In fact, more than that. Full-size hamburgers, full-size, not the chintzy ones. Full-size hamburgers are $1, both at Jack in the Box and at Burger King. Gas has just dropped back to $1.30 a gallon, and if you're in a position to buy a new car, you can get one for no money down. 0% financing for 5 years, 90 days until your first payment, and if you buy a certain GM model or a set of models, they'll throw in another $1,000 to boot to get you in the door. Now, is life good or what? This is some kind of war. I've just never been at a war quite like this one. From a casual perspective, you could learn to ignore the war completely and just go on with your life. When we were at the feast this year in Kelowna, we had a dinner, a ministerial dinner, as there usually is sometime during the feast, and we were sitting down at the table. And I think I've mentioned once before, but the gentleman there at the table with us to my left, engaged in conversation with a Canadian minister. And again, we kind of broke into the discussion on the differences between Canada and the United States, or how the United States is perceived in Canada. Canada, in that sense, is a very peace-focused nation. If you were drafted into the military back in Vietnam and you didn't want to serve, the place you went was to Canada, and you were frankly received up there with fairly open arms. You were considered a bit of a hero. It was understandable why you would flee your country, because the focus and the desire up there for peace, almost at any cost, is intensely strong. So we were discussing how the Americans, we are seen rather as aggressive, rather loud and sometimes outspoken, are running around the world asserting ourselves. And the question was brought, indeed, if we are really going to go to war, and how it seemed to be that there was quite a discussion taking place in this regard, and that there was division in the country as to whether we should or whether we should not. And I said, first of all, the division in the country is only in the press. In the fundamental sense, I don't think there is any question whatsoever as to where the country stands in regard to the matter of war. On the other hand, I said, it isn't an issue of are we going to go to war, The fact is, we are already at war. People talk as if this is something we have to discuss to see if indeed it is going to take place. And I said, I guarantee you it is already in place. It started long ago. And those who haven't recognized what is taking place simply have turned a blind eye toward reality that's around them. I want to read you something. If there's any way I can tone it down a little bit, it's written in that sense as a joke, sarcastically. But the point that's being made is very real and very true. So I'll try to at least show you what was addressed, maybe take out a little bit of the mocking tone so that the information itself doesn't get ignored. This is a message that traveled around the internet. I've seen it a couple times. I heard it on the radio one time addressed in commentary about profiling and why profiling should be considered in terms of our security nationally. But what it does is it sends you a rather long, focused message on just how long this war has begun to be in place. First question, I'll read you as it's written, then I'll just read you the actual categories. It says, in 1972 at the Munich Olympics, athletes were kidnapped and massacred by, and it gives you multiple choice options now, A, Olga Corbett, B, Sitting Bull, C, Arnold Schwarzenegger, D, Muslim male extremists, mostly between the ages of 17 and 40. Now that's the answer to every question. But the point is this, when you start listing the series of events to where indeed Muslim male extremists between the ages of 17 and 40 participated in these events, you're going to see that the battle was engaged long ago and long before many of us were willing to stop and recognize it for what it is. Now let me read you some of the series of incidents that are listed here. 1972 was the Munich Olympics. 72. We're talking over 30 years ago. 1979, U.S. Embassy in Iran was taken over. In the 1980s, a number of Americans were kidnapped in Lebanon. Do you remember all the kidnappings in Lebanon and the high profile that took at that time? That was in the 80s. In 1983, the U.S. Marine Barracks in Beirut was blown up. We are talking the same fundamental category of individuals. We're not talking about unrelated issues. In 1985, the cruise ship Achille Lauro was hijacked, and a 70-year-old American passenger was murdered and thrown overboard in his wheelchair. If you've been around a while, you'll remember those things hitting the front page of the paper. In 1985, TWA Flight 847 was hijacked in Athens, and a U.S. Navy diver trying to rescue passengers was murdered. In 1988, Pan Am Flight 103 was bombed. In 1993, the World Trade Center was bombed for the first time. You remember that? They drove a truck into the basement. Not just anybody. They drove a truck into the basement. In 1998, the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed. In September 11th, four airlines were hijacked. One was crashed as the passengers tried to stop the process. One went into the Pentagon and two into the World Trade Center complex. In 2002, we fought a war in Afghanistan against, again, elements of the same group of people. And in 2002, reporter Daniel Pearl was kidnapped and murdered. Now, the list of circumstances here that bring us down into categorically into a group of individuals of a particular faith and a particular persuasion that have assaulted and attacked not only elements in the world community, but specifically the United States, dates back here to 1972. When did the war begin? Is there still a discussion, as indeed if there is such a war taking place? Well, what then does it take to start a war if a war has not begun? You see, as long as our society can eat a dollar hamburger, fill up with $1.30 gas, drink $2 milk, purchase 25-cent macaroni and cheese, and sit down happily at our table, go happily to work, come happily home, then we have maybe the temporal possibility of saying, what war? I don't see a war. Is there a war out there somewhere? Because our lives, quite frankly, are still fairly comfortable and protected, or at least so it seems. We get used to very serious things happening all around us. They become very standard and common to us as they pass. Do you know how many years it has been since Roe versus Wade? Roe versus Wade is when the Supreme Court made the decision basically in favor of abortion, which meant essentially that you could have as many abortions as you pleased, abortions on demand. Before that, there needed to be specific medical necessity before an abortion could take place. Do you know how long we have been living with that circumstance in this country? Since 1973. Almost 30 years. And on any given year, the abortions that are taking place number then into the millions. On any given year. We've simply had this process filling around us and assaulting us in this nation for decades. I wonder if we realize how much society has suffered in the process over that time. Richard Nixon resigned from the presidency in 1974 because he was caught lying and tried to cover it up. He didn't break into the Watergate Hotel. He didn't apparently have anything to do with breaking into the Watergate Hotel, but when he found out about it, he tried to cover it up and he lied, and it cost him the presidency. Back then, if a president was caught lying, it was considered to be a dishonorable thing, and you needed to then go and do something else. That was in the 70s. That was a long time ago. Our family went down to Medford for Thanksgiving this year, as we always do, to visit with my mother and spend some time with her. And we drove down on Wednesday, and it was incredible because Wednesday night I went to bed and there was no computer waiting for me in the morning. There was no email waiting. There was basically just an open morning. I didn't get up until 11:30. I don't think I have done that since when I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. It'd be if I could go back in my mind. Thursday night, we took care of some things through the day. We had Thanksgiving dinner with my mom. And Thursday night, I went to bed a little early going, okay, I'm going to really play some catch-up. You know, I've been burning a little bit at night, and I've been using up that time, and I had a little bit of catch-up. And I thought, another night of that, and boy, will I be in fit shape. And so I went to bed reasonable time Thursday night, woke up in a couple hours, and I was worried. And I thought, what's this? I began to run through my mom's circumstances and her age. She's 84, 85 in that range, living alone and not as strong as she was last year. And she took care of my dad until he died right there in that house, and he couldn't have lived there without her caring for him. And so far she's able to care for herself, but again, there's risk to this process. And as you all know, in various ways, when it comes time to address it, it's never pretty. It's a very hard and difficult situation. And so all of a sudden I'm laying there wide awake and I'm worrying about my mother. And what's going to happen, and what would we do if something did happen? And then I began to worry about my own circumstance a little bit, and I began to pray to God and ask Him, you know, for forgiveness, and let's be close, and with no real reason to do so, but simply it was on my mind, it pressed me, and I began to respond to that. And so then I would lay there, and I would doze, and I'd wake up, and I'd pray, and I'd doze, and I'd wake up, and I'd pray, and so I tossed and turned and wrestled most of the night, and I got up in the morning, and I just thought, wow, that was terrible. And I went in, and Michelle was in the other room because she was with Megan and I had Derek with me. We had those bedrooms set up that way because we had the kids with us. And I looked at Michelle, and she just looked wrung out. And she looked at me like, you know, I could just see stress written all over her face. And so we started talking a little bit. Turns out, you know, she had tossed and turned all night with bad dreams. And I says, honey, I says, we have to understand this. This is not a coincidence. This has happened before. These are things that we're familiar with. That was simply oppression. It was simply oppression. It was spiritual oppression. It wasn't a coincidence that we both just happened to have a bad night. There were some very terrible thoughts and dreams that she wrestled with, that she laid there, and I was struggling with some fears and some things that in that sense were not really normal, or not that they had no basis whatsoever, but they weren't really normal because my relationship to God, I've been forced into Bible study that fills every crack of my day, and it's been delightful. It's been wonderful. It's been enlightening. And then as we do the Bible studies locally and we have discussion over the scriptures, and as some of you contribute and study on your own, and then we begin to discuss these things, I found it incredibly invigorating spiritually and a chance to relate in that way. And so to be laying there with those thoughts and concerns really wasn't the normal circumstance or the normal type of thing. It was a spiritual assault, the kind that we go through, the kind that we sometimes simply do not recognize, no different than the war that this nation is engaged in that sometimes we refuse to recognize as being for real. Battles and assaults, in some cases, that date clear back into the 70s, clearly, repeatedly, and yet we have walked along and lived our lives and gone to school and to our jobs and raised our families without necessarily looking around and seeing what indeed was taking place. Spiritually, in our lives, it is no different. Ephesians 6 addresses this in part, verse number 10, and the battle that we are in. Brethren, we're in a war too. It's a spiritual war. It has physical implications. But we are in the same kind of war. And we read in the Bible sometimes about things that are going to happen to God's people, persecutions God's people will face, and we think, when will that come? Well, how do we know that it hasn't already begun? I mean, what does it take? Do you have to bomb the barracks? Do you have to blow up the embassies? Do you have to take out the World Trade Center before somebody says, you know, I think something's going on here? At what point would we recognize, brethren, that the battle has already been engaged? We're not being persecuted by our government. In that sense, we're not being persecuted by this society. But we are in a spiritual war, and the implications and the ramifications of that and the society's values that we struggle against have been very consciously and specifically put in place. Ephesians 6, verse number 10. My brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand an evil day, and having done all, to stand. To be there, to stand before Christ at His return. Peter gave a series on the armor of God in the past, and so I don't really want to go into that in a specific way, but simply to mention and remind us that spiritually, brethren, we are at war, just like this nation is physically, and it is just as easy to ignore the battle that we are in as it has been for this nation to ignore the assaults that have been forged against it over recent years as well. We need to check our focus. Frank spoke about keeping our mind focused. I do deeply appreciate the contributions that are made here in teaching and helping and serving within the congregation. I appreciate that people dedicate themselves to God in such a way that we can truly get up here and speak and mesh together in messages, and God will work through us in service to His people in that way. It is a miraculous process. I am deeply grateful for it. And it's remarkable when it plays out. We are indeed at war. This past week, I updated my day timer. I have a day timer that I keep my appointments and dates and schedules on. And I had not maintained it, updated, and passed all the notes forward since August. So for those of you, like Brenda asked me for something, and I never got back to her on it, and Drew asked for something, and never quite got back to Drew on it. So there's a few things that I said, well, you have a paper on this or something on this. I said, well, let me check. Well, if you've asked me since August, it maybe just didn't quite get done. And I've made the visits, the emergencies. If you died, I went and did the funeral. You know, I mean, things like that I took care of. But there were things that just didn't get totally taken care of in the process. And so I was going back this week, finally bringing all the notes forward, and I thought, what has happened? Why do I have this? Well, the topical index I started on in August, and I saw my initial notes back there in terms where I first started writing scriptures down. I gave the index today to Donna, and some of you are assisting Donna with the proofreading of that, which will be done through this week. And I looked at it, and there's about 1,500 to 1,800 scriptures now listed on the index. And I says, I think I can understand what happened in all those months. But the fact is, I began to update it, and then I began to stop and think about this. You know, for 3 months, my life has been like little bright light bulbs going off day by day by day. When I would read notes that were turned in on hospitality and then look at the scriptures in my Bible and then study them to put them in the index, I'm thinking about scriptures that said, you know, don't let a widow be numbered among the group unless she has entertained strangers or brought them into her home. I had scriptures where Job said, well, you know, I didn't leave anybody out in the street. You know, they weren't out there abandoned. They were, I gave them room and hospitality. And I began to think, boy, you know, it's like little pinpricks when you read the scripture and it says, well, here's what you should be doing in terms, here's what you have opportunity in faith. Here's what you need to be considering in hospitality. Here's what modesty is. Here's what virtue is and truth. And all of these scriptures become flooding in, and all of a sudden it's like you're having to stop and say, one, this is exciting. Two, this is sobering. And three, you know, I have to be able to address this. But it's because of just by circumstance, I'm literally just drinking in hour after hour after hour because of this project, the Word of God. And I have to say, it has impacted my life and my mentality and my focus in a phenomenal way. I had no choice but to begin to process and meditate on these things. And Paul was telling Timothy, when you teach, when you serve God's people, 1 Timothy 4, he was giving him instruction in terms of how this should then be carried out. And there's application for us in that. We need to find our focus. We're at war. The assault began long ago. There will be serious battles in the future, but we should not think that the battle has yet to engage, that the end time has yet to start, that the finish of this process is kind of waiting out there somewhere in the future. That's not the way this is. That's like saying, well, I wonder if the United States is going to go to war. We've been at war. We were at war before we even recognized it. 1 Timothy 4, verse number 11. These things command and teach. Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. All of us have to be the example as best we were able. Till I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy with the laying on of the hands of the presbytery. He was ordained into the ministry. He was called out and given a special responsibility. And then notice verse 15, what Paul was telling Timothy to do in order to be of service to God. He says, meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them. It's like diving in instead of sticking your toe in the water. Go ahead and immerse yourself completely in these things. Give yourself entirely to them that your progress may be evident to all. Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine, continuing them, for in doing this you will both save yourself and those who hear you. You know, a wife in the Bible is shown as by her example she might save her husband. That the children are sanctified, which by the example and care of the parents indeed might, in that sense, contribute toward the salvation of their children. And so we are our brother's keeper, and we have a great responsibility in that way. But we do that by diving in and enmeshing ourselves totally in the process of serving God and fulfilling His will. You can't be on the outside, hang around the edge, leave off there by yourself, because the church is actually an assembly. And God did that for a purpose, so that we might build unity working together. We are not, in that sense, the church on the corner. I've had a couple of calls in the last couple of weeks of new people interested, excited. There was a couple down in Idaho that were actually in Earl Romer's area, but when they looked on the internet, they didn't know who to call, so they emailed all the ministry around the area, And I got back and saw it, and so I just sent him down a note and engaged. And the minute I engaged, it was like, okay, here's the question. Call us. We'll come see you. We'll come to Spokane. We got another couple down here. They're reading the good news. We'll all get together. Maybe we can get on the internet and hook it up. We can talk to each other, and we'll just have a lot of conversations. I mean, they were fired up and ready to go. And finally, I called Earl Roman and said, Earl, you know, oh, I hope you're back from whatever you were doing. Call these people. I need to disengage. Not because it wasn't fun and exciting and I'd been happy to help them, but because I'm not where I can actually go sit down and visit them myself. That's where he actually operates, and I'm not going to be there. And so they needed someone who could actually walk through the process with them. But it was incredible. It was exciting to see. I wish you had the opportunity to see those kinds of things. But God has indeed called us, and we are here, not because it's convenient. Alice was at Bible study on Wednesday, and Alice comes down from Priest Rivers, at least the mail address, and we meet in Hayden, and she's only there for an hour and a half Bible study, and it's at night, and it's during the winter. Now, why would you do that? Because of what we believe. Not because it's convenient or local or it's a social thing to do, but because of what we believe. When you're in the military, you work and you train during the day, and then probably at some level in your training, you're going to be pulling guard duty at night. Somebody has to pull guard duty. All I know is that wherever I went, it seemed like we did it a lot. And when you're on guard duty, you absolutely have to stay awake. If you fall asleep on guard duty, that is, I don't know what the description would be. To us, we would call it maybe a capital offense. You cannot do that. Your life is at risk, and everybody else's that you're watching for. So falling asleep on guard duty was a very serious offense. I used to do anything I had to stay awake. I remember one of the nastiest things I've ever understood about is chewing tobacco. And I used to take a big wad of wintergreen leaf and stick it inside my lip so that I could sit sometime on guard duty and absolutely be awake. And I'm going to tell you, if you don't chew tobacco and you stick a plug of that garbage in your mouth, you are not going to go to sleep. If you did, you would execute yourself. So... but I remember sitting there with that gross-tasting plug of stuff in my mouth, and I'm telling you, my eyes were wide awake. I could see anybody who was there. We need to live our lives recognizing there is a spiritual war on, that we are in the midst of it, and that we need to do whatever it takes to keep our eyes open and our focus on what God would have us to do. We cannot be caught up and living in our life of the past. We have to go forward to live as God has called us. Now, Frank was up here, and he jumps into Ephesians chapter 5, and it made me nervous because I was using Ephesians 4 and 6, but he was very proper, stayed right in the middle. Ephesians 4, verse 17. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of your mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardening of their heart. Have you ever had a disagreement with someone that you loved and that you feel very affectionate towards? And then in the course of the disagreement, you began to be a little bit irritated. And then as you thought about the disagreement, your heart began to kind of harden and firm up in a negative way. Have you ever been there? I mean, at least today or... Yeah, I've been there, and it talks about their hearts are hardened. Our heart can be hardened. We can begin to think on something that happened or took place. We can begin to focus on it in a certain way. Satan comes in spiritually, inserts the thought in our mind, stirs up our mind, and reinforces the thought, and we feed on it, and we think it's just a normal physical process. It's a spiritual battle. It's a war, and he's trying to take us out. It's how he works. It's simply the way the system is functioning, because of the hardening of their heart, who, being past feeling, have given themselves over to licentiousness to work all uncleanness and greediness. Being past feeling means you get to the point where you say, look, I don't care. Well, before that, you did care. And before that, you really cared. But because of the heart being hardened, I don't care. And so this happens. It's a normal process, but by normal, it's normal in the sense of what was Steve saying in terms of virtual reality. It's normal in virtual reality, but it's not normal in reality, which is God. Who being past feeling have given themselves over to licentiousness, to work all uncleanness with greediness. But you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man which was created according to God in righteousness and true holiness. So we're walking through the process where our hearts are softened, our mind is opened, and our fruitfulness is to be enhanced. We're nurtured and fertilized in that sense almost spiritually so that we would bear much fruit. God calls us out of this world and out of the morals of this society. R.V. Wade, Roe versus Wade, does not impact us in a personal way in that we simply do not go that way. That doesn't make us better than anyone else. Rather, frankly, it should humble us. It should humble us indeed when we see ourselves as we really are. In the book of Romans, in chapter 12, is a passage about this same thing where we're supposed to change in this process of our calling and become something else and be very fruitful and have our minds opened and see where it is that we need to go. Romans 12. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. See, in this world, the suicide bomber sacrifices himself and everybody else with him. In God's world, we sacrifice ourselves for everyone else. We don't take them with us. We give ourselves to them. We help them. A living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And then it goes on and begins to describe the gifts that God gives us of service to each other. And he says that we should not only have gifts of service, we should use them. And the ones we have, we should use well. We should focus on them. We should have something in our mind that we understand we are able to do. God did not call us to destruction. He called us to fruitfulness. And if we're to be fruitful, then we have to bear individual types of fruit. And so there should be a gift indeed, or many gifts, depending on what God's blessings on us are and what our desires are, in which we serve each other. Verse 6, having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. If prophecy or speaking for God or teaching or speaking under his influence, let us prophesy in proportion to our faith. Or ministry, which means service or servant, let us use in our ministering. He who teaches in teaching. He who exhorts in exhortation. He who gives with liberality. He who leads with diligence. He who shows mercy with cheerfulness. He who prays. He who intercedes on others' behalf. He who focuses in order to understand and shares. He who encourages, you can take that list on out as far as you have time indeed to go. Each of us should be actively serving God in some specific way. We should be consciously trying to fulfill that part of God's will. There's a war on, we're in it, battles are being fought, and to be sitting by watching all the smoke and the carnage and all of the destruction just floating on by while others fight the war is not what God has called us to do. We don't fight the war by sipping Mai Tais by the pool. We fight the war when we engage in a very direct and ready way. Now there's some scriptures in Revelation 12 that I want to hit in a cursory manner, I'll say. I don't want to go into a lot of the prophetic detail. We have a book, the book of Revelation Unveiled, and in the midst of the book, on page, I've got it marked here, if I can turn to it, starting on page 20, It says Satan's war against the people of God. And it goes through to the degree that we have understanding and have printed this. And it goes through and describes the war and how it's a war against God's people. And then it describes some of the beast and the time of Jacob's trouble. So it goes through and addresses some of those issues in a prophetic way. But I want to look at these in a more cursory way because of a point that is mixed into the midst. Revelation 12, and in this case I'd like to start in verse number 7. War broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought. They did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called Devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Now I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God night and day has been cast down. And so the context here is that in the context of Christ's return, of the kingdom being set up to be established, in that time frame and context, Satan is cast down in a way that causes specific and additional trauma to take place. But it is before the return of Jesus Christ because of the information that is also here. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives to death. Rejoice therefore, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea. So this is before Satan is actually bound during the millennium during Christ's rule. So woe to those who are still on the earth at that time. The devil has come down to you having great wrath because he knows that he has a short time. So there is a period of time considered to be prophetically short before Christ's return where Satan is especially angry and has been rebuked and cast down in a specific way, and he comes out and after and begins to assault the church. Now, if we were, again, to look at this nation and we would say, well, when did this war that we were in begin? And people would generally say, well, it began when we were attacked on September 11th. Well, what about the first time they attacked the towers? What about the first time they blew up the embassies? What about the first time they took out the Marines in their barracks? I mean, when did the war? The war began long before we began to fight it. The assault was in place for decades before we turned and began to actively try to defend ourselves. When do you think Satan became angry with the church? At what point did he decide he would like to take us out? I think if we process this from the fact that, well, this is immediately right before Christ's return, we're going to see it, we're still looking for it in the future, I think we're going to miss the point. You don't think Satan was angry when he destroyed the corporate structure of the church in 1995? You don't think Satan was already angry then? It was like taking a piece of glass. Somebody asked me, again, one of the people who've called and shown interest in the church because they had some background with the church, and they were kind of saying, well, what happened? Is there, you know, did the people go to here or there or what? And I said, no, it's like taking a piece of glass and dropping it on the concrete. It doesn't break in half. It shatters. I said, so it was like the church in that sense, in terms of association, just shattered. And I said, the United Church of God has maintained and regrouped and built together and is trying to serve God and do his purpose as best we understand in this way. But, you know, Satan was the one who took the glass and threw it on the concrete, not God. God allowed it, but Satan's the one who threw it down. So are we waiting for him to assault us? Are we watching the world to see when indeed he finally gets upset? Well, he's already upset, and we're already under attack. And we're already exposed if indeed we are not submitting ourselves under God's protection and fulfilling our purpose in that way. And we have to recognize that. The battle has already long since been engaged. Whether this specific event or not is taking place in the future or recent past, I can't tell because God hasn't told me those specific prophetic things. But the battle has already been engaged. Verse 13. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast down to earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and a half a time from the presence of the serpent. And so there is a specific reference here that, as we understand, refers to the time of the tribulation, to a 3.5-year period of time where the church is protected. And yet, indeed, not everyone who has indeed access to God is protected in that specific way. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So as long as we can eat our burgers for a dollar, drink our milk for two, and have macaroni and cheese for a dollar, we can just sit back and wait for this to happen and see what comes when it takes place. Do you not think there would be an assault wave long before Satan comes in with the main force? Do they not send in, as we have, people on the ground in Iraq right today, already on the ground before the war is engaged? Do we not think Satan operates much the same way? The battle has already been set in place. Some of the specific events will have yet to obviously play out, but the battles are already in place. Revelation 13, just going on a little further, verse 1. We're talking a beast system here. And we're talking a beast system that portrays historical development of the beast, and then an ongoing process where the beast has always been after God's people. You don't have to wait for that. You don't have to look for that. That has always been taking place. It is ongoing. Then I stood in the sand of the sea. I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and if you go back to the book of Daniel, and we've studied this in various ways. In fact, we have a picture of the beast here on the front of our cover on the book of Revelation Unveiled as we have portrayed it. I don't think they actually got a picture. In fact, I saw in the paper this week that we don't have an Obama. What do we have? We have Bigfoot. They finally admitted the family that had run around in the costume and tramped feet all over the forest and started a world controversy finally admitted, because the man had died, that that was actually them. So it's not like we got a picture of this guy running through the neighborhood, but this is a artist rendition. I saw one of its heads, verse 3, as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. And they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? It says he's given a mouth speaking great things. Blasphemy means speaking against the truth, speaking against the true God, promoting indeed a false worship and a false religion. He was given authority to continue 42 months, so there's a specific reference here as well to the period of end time that we recognize as the tribulation. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him. Now understand, there's an end time ramification of this, but there's also a process whereby this beast has, excuse me, don't want to drink the little thing on top. I guess the doily is to filter out the bugs while you drink it. Verse 7, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So again, there is an element of this that is fixed firmly in the very end, but there is a process, quite frankly, that has been taking place all along. I assure you, the battle is already engaged. We cannot imagine somehow that we're just going to sit and wait and see what takes place. We are on our way, and I doubt that we really know just how far along we really are. The battle we fight is spiritual. It's against spiritual wickedness in high places. It requires a very high focus in our prayers, a very high focus in our personal study, in staying close to God, in looking out for, praying for, caring for each other. Christ mentioned that in his life that there was a limit to the things that he could do and when he was able to do them. Obviously, in our lives, our limits are very much in that way the same. John chapter 9, there is a time when we can work, and there is a time when no more work will be able to be done. John 9, verse 4. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And he said he would shine through us, that we're children of light, and therefore we have to work while it is day. We don't have a clue when this is going to shut down. We don't have any idea when this is all going to go up in smoke. Someday it will. Someday the economy will collapse. Someday Europe will rise up in a military and economic system that is bigger than anything we have ever seen. These things prophetically are prophesied, they will take place. But we can't wait for them and watch and say, okay, finally, the battle has been engaged. That's simply not how these things take place. We cannot afford to live our lives just being comfortable, even though at times we must wonder indeed what comfort really is. And it's because we live with so much that in many cases we don't understand. We understand stress. And some who lived through the difficult times of this nation remember what it was like physically to go without or to do without or to have nothing in return. Many of us, quite frankly, have simply never tasted that in our lives, even to this day. In the book of Joshua, when Joshua was taking over for Moses, and the account in Joshua 1 is here, where Joshua was being told indeed to focus, and Joshua wanted to make sure that he passed on the words of God to the people, but God specifically wanted Joshua to realize how this process would take place. And Joshua 1 says, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, and said, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread on, I have given you, as I said to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites and the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Now there were times when men were able to stand before Israel, but it was when Israel had not turned and submitted themselves fully to God. If Israel submitted to God, then no one could indeed stand, because God is the power of this universe. Be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Don't pull back a little bit. Stand up and be counted. Stand where you believe and do so courageously, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Don't turn from it to the right hand or to the left. Don't compromise. Don't buy into society. Don't step in there just a little bit with your toe in the water. Stay away from that which this society has chosen apart from God, and serve God first, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, which means we should talk about it. We should think about it. We should read it and study it. It ought to be something that comes up in the course of encouraging each other. We ought to know where in the Bible to turn to look to answer a question when we have asked for the hope that is in us. But you shall meditate on it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. We know this society is ultimately going to fail. We know the kingdom of God is going to be set up over the whole earth, but we need to be working now. We prepare now. We engage now. The battle has long since begun. We need to work while it is yet day. We're the children of light. Our light needs to be seen. Our voices need to be heard as God gives us opportunity. Not the time to take up a defensive position, to hunker down, and to hold on and to wait it out. This is a time to step out on faith, to look to God, to trust God, and to prepare ourselves to participate and to serve Him as fully as we possibly can in what He has called us to do.